Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Many of you know I've been ill for the last few weeks with complications from kidney stones and surgery. So I'm a little bit off today. That's the reason. And again, to my friends who have donated to me, I thank you. This has been a brutal year so far for me, and that kind of support is extraordinary. Ultimately, it all comes down to paying legal debt from, 3 years ago. For a divorce that I, didn't want. Although I guess I knew it was a necessity. So I thank you very, very, very much for helping me. Today, we're going to deal with something that I've written on and published on before, but I've not done in podcast form. And it's very important. It's the Prince St. Vladimir Monomakh and the uprising of 1113 in Kiev. This was explicitly anti-usury and anti-Khazar, or Judea. What occurred was, Svatopolk II had ruled Kiev only because of his alliance with Khazar capital. His main source of financial support was Jewish usury at the time. And the chronicles state that the invasion of the Turkic Polovtsi from the south were God's punishment for this policy. So upon the death of Yaroslav in 1054, his successor was Izyaslav. And he was a prince of the powerful, independent western state of Turov. And he was challenged, though. Izyaslav was his return was demanded, and he did something that, of course, you can't really do in Russian history, is he went to Rome. This is not the first time this has happened in the Maluten-Dragutin split in Serbian medieval history. It was a Dragutin who went to Rome seeking assistance and financial help. Once Svatoslav died, four princes vied for power. The Sevalod, Svatopolk II, Vladimir Monomakh, and Izyaslav. The coalition of the Sevalod and Svatopolk II then ruled the state and finally defeated the embattled Izyaslav. So the point is, the context of the situation is constant violence. This period of Kievan history, a lack of stability, a lack of institutional foundations. And often what they would do is go to foreign sources for money and diplomatic support. Svatopolk Izyaslavich went to the usurers to control Kiev. And they would use the Turkic tribe, whether it be the steppe nomads of Polotsi, even the Germans and Poles were used to destroy their opponents. So even the sovereignty of the state was at stake. At one time, Kiev was very strong, law-bound economy, and ultimately now the will to power was the only thing that was left. And as society became more and more demoralized, as the moral life collapsed under the constant violence, money lending became more and more acceptable. You have to remember that in times of severe stress, especially warfare over years, social morals usually collapses because all anyone sees is the rule of the stronger and violent, and life is cheap. Rebuilding from that is extremely difficult. And where Russia has had that more than most societies. And at the time here, Kiev was one of the largest and certainly the wealthiest states in medieval Europe. And so when Svyatopluk II gave the usurers complete free reign, the oligarchy would move in and develop. Slavery resurfaced, although they called it debt bondage. And for many, it was the only recourse. The embargo on Galicia was a major salt exporter of Central Europe, and to speculate on that was a way to make money. One of the ways that, by the way, the Kiev Caves Monastery released its salt stores, reducing the price to a manageable level, meaning that they broke the backs of the speculators on salt. They were manipulating the price and even withholding supply in certain cases, but they made supply far more manageable then. And at that point, the population quickly reversed that. They marched straight to the Jewish quarter of Kiev, and all the salt was found there. This isn't a story. This is history. They realized that they knew where it was. I mean, it could be certainly another oligarch who had been dispossessed. But it shows the level of immorality at the time. The level of immorality at a time where there was no stable political institutions. There was, however, a stable religious institution. And this is why I say that, without the church, there is no Russia. There could have been no Russia. The church was the only institution that stood consistently for Russian unity in the face of foreign control and domination. There are many times in Russian history where her sovereignty was at stake, the time of troubles, the very early 17th century, and even at this point. And just before this, as many of you know, the Khazar control over the slave trade of southern Ukraine made them the most powerful empire in Europe. At least the most feared empire in Europe. The lives of the saints show this. The Patriarchon of the Kiev Caves, as well as the Chronicles, they both state clearly that these new oligarchs, coming on the backs of the rule of usury, they always know they shouldn't rule, but they have no right to rule. Now, they're always very nervous. And really, the ultimate result of all of this was that once he died, there was a massive revolt against debt bondage in 1113. This was a certainly mob violence, but it was one where you had substantial amount of writing such that the agenda was very clear. It was an agrarian revolt, really, against unearned income. Now, if you read history books in English, it'll say that it was directed against the feudal elite. Well, that's very vague, and I think it's deliberately vague. You even heard that in the Soviet era, in Soviet textbooks. But let me quote from M.N. Tikhomirov. There's no relation to the right-wing writer Tikhomirov. He was a Soviet-era historian, definitely worth reading. Quote, "It was directed against exploitation in all forms, and clearly usury and the resultant bankruptcy and forfeiture of its victims. The collection of compounding interest became a tool for the enrichment of the boyars, merchants, and upper clergy. All the religious canons always insisted that usury is a sinful thing. All church decisions in this regard were purely of a declaratory nature. During the second half of the 12th century, Ilya, Bishop of Novgorod, threatened severe punishment for clergy engaging in this practice. Monastic usury was widespread and carried under various pretexts." That's an awful, awful analysis of the situation. Actually, I quote it because it's typical of the fraud that's out there and still being promoted. There is very little evidence of any kind of systematic usury among clergy. Monasteries were non-monetized at the time. The only monetized parts of the economy were Judea. Jews controlled banking in the country at the time, and so they made themselves very easy targets for the riots that they engendered. But there is no conception of any kind of bureaucratic power such that you could haul your you know people into court. All canons are declaratory in that sense. You know, the prohibitions against usury have been obeyed. And usury, let's be clear here, we're not really talking about excessive interest. First of all, because excessive is already a negative judgment, it doesn't mean very much. It really refers to rents. The condemnations of usury are condemnations of living off of unearned income. That's the most important concept. And that's what has not been in any of the discussions on this so far. I believe Michael Hoffman has made that very clear, but otherwise I haven't heard it. The nature of things was that usury concerns all income that didn't come from labor. What is a rent? These days, it's one of the most important concepts in our economy. A rent is a income that's derived from non-economic power. So if you a corrupt a bureaucrat, any way they could manipulate the system such that they can raise the price of something. If you're the only game in town, if you've made sure that no one's going to, you're the only person that you could buy salt from in an area because the regime is defending that, then that's absolutely a rent. I've said before in America that defense attorneys, criminal defense attorneys, and divorce attorneys, and custody attorneys are charging rent because people who hire them are so frightened, are so inexperienced, that they'll pay anything to get out of the trouble that they've been brought into for whatever reason. But there is an exception in Russia, and I've said this before, that is in Novgorod. Novgorod is one of the essential parts of medieval Russia, an essential aspect of her identity. It was deeply usurious at her upper levels. It was, of course, a republican system of government, and it was simply a cover for oligarchy. That was removed the moment it ceased to assist them anymore. The entire economy was based on usury, the merchant class, and exploitation. Novgorod is very marshy. Not a lot grows there. Well, it's true that there is plenty of incomes that were taken from the land. Her position as the largest city in the Hanseatic League made sure that commerce was the dominant way that the people made their money. Now, it's not a condemnation of commerce as such. It is, though, the idea that this elite made sure that they were the only game in town. This elite maintained regular ties with Poland, Lithuania, anywhere else, and they're one aspect of a oligarchy in a republican system is that they have no real loyalty other than to their money. Their loyalty could be changed at a moment's notice. This is why Moscow needed to act very quickly against them. It was from Novgorod that the Strugalniki and the Judaizer heresies spread. And both of those movements, by the way, almost ritualized usury. So there are several marks of a republican government. Even in a better sense, you have in Italy as well as Novgorod itself, the idea being that it is ruled by bankers. It is ruled by people who know that they have no right to rule, and therefore they have to hide. Oligarchs never reveal themselves. They'll use some other institution, some other method to convince people that they're the real deal. One problem with that is that once the traditional authority is gone, the oligarchs are now just naked and exposed. This is one of the reasons why they went to Ivan the Terrible when he had retired, resigned, saying, I can't rule, I can't do this anymore. The oligarchs tried to steal anything that wasn't nailed down, typical of them, and they realized that they were going to be killed. Traditional authority was necessary to give them just some shred of legitimacy and control. So this is why Moscow had to act very quickly here, because in this point in time, northern Russia, sovereignty of the state was at stake, because they knew that the ruling elite, the slave-owning elite, so to speak, had no real loyalty and would switch to Poland or Germany as they saw fit. That's why I mentioned Svetopolk II went to Rome, Izyaslav, depending on the usurers. They have no loyalties other than their power. It's the money, I should say. It's the leverage that anyone can use against them, making them very vulnerable. Now, beyond that, the problem with the quote I just mentioned, that there was never any systematic methods here used. Only the Jewish banking system. It's true that it was not, that the great banks were far in the future, but even at this time, you did have a systematic regime amongst the Kahals. At this point, the middle point of the Middle Ages. This is not a rebellion against feudalism as such. The fact is that the Jews monopolized usury by the 12th century in Russia, And so Tikhomirov, in this case, is totally incorrect. And I think he's incorrect on purpose. Normally, when you hear a historian like him, who's good in many aspects, and he's very technical and very specific, then all of a sudden becomes very vague, you know he's covering for somebody. And usually it's a powerful group, and it's overwhelmingly the Jewish elite. Svatopluk II tolerated the Jewish trade in Russian slaves. This is their great sin against the Russian people, which has yet to be dealt with. The governor of Crimea was a Jew, by the way, at the time. This was a point of great decline in the Byzantine Empire. The man actually had been formerly a Christian. And by converting to Judaism, it was much easier then to trade in slaves. While the Khazar state had been smashed, you know, before, the domination of Jewish traders in the area had not abated. In this case, Svatopluk brought them into Kiev as a means to ensure an income against his relatives. He pulled out all the stops, and if you can use the same thing was done by the Polish nobility, roughly around the same time, actually. Bring the Jews, make a deal with them, you can outspend your enemies. But it's a terrible bargain. In the Russian case, it's because Jews had used the Polotsian raiders to obtain slaves. There were Turk people, and they now have Jewish patronage. It's very rare that you could find in English textbooks that these raids from the south, from the steppe, had a Jewish backing, that they were now organized and systematic. By about 1090, these raids increased substantially. The slaves were then sold to the Jews on Crimea, on the island of Kaffa. By all accounts, Jewish slave dealers had a special hatred for Slavic slaves. Saint Eustratin, the faster of the Kiev caves, according to the Patirik, was taken in a Povatsi raid, along with maybe 20, 30 of others, and he was sold to what's called a ferocious Jew on Korsun. Trying to force him to renounce Orthodoxy, he was tortured to death by the Jewish slave traders. All told, about 50 Russians died this way from the same raid. So Saint Eustratin is a martyr against Jewish slavery. And so you have this right in the Kiev caves itself, which is not really known for that kind of talk. But by ferocious Jew, I think what they mean is that they went far beyond any economic interest that a slave can offer. It was a matter of hatred. Now, the background is like this. Saint Vladimir had five sons. Upon his death, Svatoslav attempted to form his own state in Tura. Yaroslav had fought against this. The former was killed in the fighting in Novgorod. He then had to fight Svatopluk. And then he used Polish soldiers to take Kiev away from him. And it made their paymaster very unpopular. So whoever would defeat him would be very popular by default. So Yaroslav defeated Svatopluk, but the resulting power was too much for Mstislav, the grandson of Vladimir. In other words, when one became too strong, the others would combine against him. When one became too popular, the others would be envious. So the next generation saw Izyaslav, the son of Yaroslav the Wise, defeated for Kiev by Vsevolod, and then going to Rome. And in fact, it's not commonly stated, but Izyaslav, the Grand Prince of Kiev, had converted to the Roman Church in Poland. Now, with Svetoslav's death, the Vsevolod and Izyaslav made peace, but this was only very temporary. The coalition of Vsevolod and Monomakh defeated him, and he died in 1078. The point is that in this era, the population was desperate. The population wanted a deliverer. Now, you didn't have a mass media like you do today that can call black-white and white-black. But by going to the Roman Church and converting, Izyaslav had renounced Russia and renounced everything Russian, culturally speaking. In return for his support, for their support, I should say, the first Kievan synagogue was built by him. His father, Izyaslav, during one of the many civil wars of that era, fled to Poland for assistance. While living there, he became a very strong Judeophile, Semitophile, Philo-Semitic, I should say. Then he ran to the Germans, promising to make Kiev a tributary of the German state if an army were given to him. He was even willing to accept papal rule over Kiev. It's from this Jewish influx under Izyaslav that Jews first came into Russia. Poland being ground zero for them. Having lived there for a while in exile, he learned this coalition between Polish nobles and Jewish elites, and liked the idea. It used Jews for their money-making abilities. The Jews use you for protection and legitimacy. But to give the Jews permission to enslave Russians in exchange for regular subsidy is a bit of a problem. The synagogue, remember something here. It's not meant as a prayer house. That's not how it is. It was a fortress for protection. Now, it's true it was protected. In Kiev, the Jews never quite needed it prior to this. They had a martial tradition of their own. But Jewish usury had made much of the, had driven the country into debt, especially when facing unrest among the various princes. And foreign occupation, defeats from the Turks, the population had enough. This is the background for the looting of the Jewish quarter in Kiev. So you have several entities. Number one, extreme instability in the government. Number two, not a lot of respect for the very temporary holders of that office. I mean, there was respect for the office of Grand Prince of Kiev, but not of these people individually. Number three, a decline in moral life. Number four, the influx of Jewish capital. It came from this Philo-Semitic idea of Izyaslav living in Poland in exile. He then converted to the Roman Church, as I mentioned. And finally, the resurrection of the idea of debt bondage. The mob looted the Jewish quarter that same year, 1113. Sorry about that. I know this is complicated. There's a lot of players. When I first was studying this, it drove me crazy. Historians are just stupid when they try to simply list events in order, as if a chronicle is going to mean anything. The bigger question is, what's really going on underneath that? Why was Kiev worth having? Who were the major players? Where were they getting their money and their income? What was the foreign penetration into the area? This is what a historian should be dealing with. But dealing with these names, these crazy names that no one else has, that Russians today don't have, you know, it's it drives you mad. I understand. But the Jews offered the elite something. The elite, they offered the elite capital and liquidity at a rate lower than everybody else. No one could match their rates. So there was a meeting of the princes, including the Jews needed to be expelled from Kiev. The riot in 1113 was very popular. It was aimed at the Jews and the Gentiles that had business relationships with them. And these were well known at the time. The boyars had feared for their money, and they sent for Monomakh to restore law and order. They even tried to tell him that if the violence was left unchecked, they'll go after your daughter and family, raping them and killing them. This was a lie, of course, because he was not involved with usury, and so he was not in danger. They were trying to create this panic in him, get him to restore law and order so that they can continue their profiteering. So they wrote to him saying, "Come, Prince, to Kiev, for us to stop the violence. The Jews will attack the nobles, the monasteries, and even the royal family itself. They will plunder if you don't come." We need to be clear, though, that when historians use vague terms like feudal exploitation, that phrase didn't exist at the time. It was too vague. You know, that may be a Marxist phrase later on, in a systematic way, but that there was no concept of this general vague exploitation. It was specific. It was directed against those merchants, Jews, and those connected with them, especially foreigners, no connection to the soil, and hence used human material for profit. The opposite of actually creating something. The targets were those who seemed to have no roots. The oligarchs had no roots at all if they're willing to, you know, turn themselves into any organization to support any religion and or political party if it suits their interests. That was the case then, that's the case now. The power of the boyar class at the time was very obnoxious, and its faction fighting destroyed the property of Galicia. And the nobles really only cared for profit. They used Turks, Cumans, Poles, Hungarians, Tartars to invade the territory of their rival. Well, this economy, because of the salt mines as well as the trade routes, was destroyed. Jews were singled out. This is true. Why? Because they used systematic and deceitful means to manipulate the peasantry. The famed historian Sergei Soloviev says the Jewish banking class, very ethnically conscious, quote, "they had immense power, which is why many merchants and artisans were ruined," end quote. So there were very specific reasons for targeting the Jews and those connected with them. And in the popular mind, I think Poles and Jews were connected as almost one person. Now, what happened was Monomakh, the strongest of the leaders at the time, came up with, and the Council of Princes that brought him in, came up with a comprehensive anti-usury legislation. First of all, interest could not be compounded. He did not make a distinction between charging for the use of money and usury. It was all the same thing. Any interest was usury for him. The interest charge couldn't be more than the principal. If the lender tried to charge more than the principal over time, the debtor was freed from the obligation of paying it at all. The maximum rate of interest could never exceed 20% yearly. Benguerti statute protected the property of smallholders and artisans from confiscation. Debt slavery was outlawed. Repayment could be done on an installment plan for up to 5 years if the debtor had a regular income. Interest could not be collected for longer than 2 years. After that, the loan was no longer interest bearing. In other words, let me clarify here the idea of the interest and principal. It was often the case that the interest would create a debt far greater even than the original amount of money. When that occurred, the debt was over. That was just one aspect of it. When the debtor had to work off a loan, he had the rights of any other Russian who was not a slave. The only time slavery was permitted is if the debtor tried to defraud the creditor. In the testament of the Metropolitan of Kiev, Nikifor, he states the following, quote, "If you take the wealth of your brother through usury, it will do you no good and provide no security or virtue. If you eat meat, you are not eating the meat of sheep or other animals, but the flesh of your brothers. Cutting into his flesh for the evil methods of extortion, bribery, and unjust debt collections," end quote. That quote is not mentioned very much in the English language history books on the question. But it's literally cannibalism at that point. It's a short-term way of destroying an economy and then moving on to another one. And they were aware of this. This was the Khazar way, and it was well known at the time. So this is a substantial amount of anti-usury, anti-Judaic, anti-Khazar legislation coming from Kiev. And of course, Vladimir Monomakh has been canonized on the Russian and Ukrainian churches. And this deserves a far greater circulation than it has at the present. And it also shows that the idea of Khazaria wasn't just an empire. It wasn't just a group of mercenaries. It was a concept. It was a way of life they were trying to eradicate. So what are we talking about here with Khazaria? The connection here is very clear and very important. The empire by the early 8th century reached from the West Caucasus to the Sea of Azov and took almost the entire steppe. Its capital lay to the mouth of the Volga, and the work of Lev Gumilev, the Khazar Civil War of 810-820, led to the total Judaization of the elites. The war was between Islam and Judaism, two social views very similar, but ultimately it concerned the orientation of this commercial parasite. The war between elites between 810 and 820, was about Islam and Judaism. Which one to pick? Judaism gave a tremendous amount of freedom. They wouldn't be subject to a local power. Islam would force them into that category. It's one of the reasons they chose it. The empire in Gumilev's phrasing, it was a chimera. defined as anything having two distinct functions. A cacophony. And the cacophony is only understood subconsciously. It consists of a state without any real ethnic or racial basis, merely a group of people held together by force. The ethnic mix was chaotic, maintaining the Jewish ruling class secure. So you had a multicultural regime held together by mercenaries, and the war between Islam and Judaism in the beginning of the 9th century solidified that ruling class. Remember something. Gog and Magog, in the Book of Revelations and Daniel and elsewhere. This was used exclusively to refer to Khazaria. It was only during the Crimean War that British propaganda tried to equate Rus with Rosh and Rus. Actually, that term refers to the chief prince rather than a people. The Khazar king at one time was referred to as the prince of Rosh, Mesek and Tubal. So it was just, you know, it had no real meaning other than that. This was the force of Antichrist. The Pavoltian Pechnik forces that harassed Kiev throughout most of its existence were, at least in the popular mind, associated with Jewish control over the slave trade. I was a prophet for the nomads. Now, Kluczewski argues that the short-term loans were extremely expensive and not really regulated by the law at all. But he argues generally that the real agenda of the Jewish moneylenders at the time wasn't so much a quick payoff, but the destruction of Russian capital. Default meant that property went to the Jews and debtors became slaves. So sometimes the debt isn't really about money. It's about destroying your opponent. Now, as we all know, the Russians destroyed the Khazar Khanate, and the Jews then migrated to Morocco, which they orchestrated nomadic attacks on Russia. It didn't end there. It didn't end with the Khazar Empire. The Khazar Empire was an ethnic elite control. So if the Khanate itself was destroyed and they moved to another city, nothing really changed. Since the Jews had tremendous experience in banking, they could very easily dominate their Gentile competitors. And this served as a convenient midpoint between Byzantium and Kiev, and was one of the one time, by the way, Murshkan was one of the capital of St. Vladimir because of its location on the river. And this is where the Jews went after the destruction of Khazaria. But rather than making war on the nomads, Izyaslav would much rather hire them out rather than fight them. You know, for the first time, 1068, the voice of the elite, the Visha, became a popular voice in Russia. The ruling class and pagan aristocracy were planning on working with the Poles, Jews, and nomads. Then those patriotic of the elite organized into that Visha. That's where it came from. Izyaslav took his revenge on this, though, on the urban poor. The point I'm trying to make is that the Visha was the assembly. In old Kiev, you had the prince, his military advisors, kind of like a senate, and the Visha was an urban assembly made up largely of elites, but elites from different quarters of the population. That only came into existence, though, when Izyaslav abused his authority and brought the Jews in and was using the Turks against Russians. And Izyaslav was able to profit from this. So making war on the urban population was a matter of revenge to some extent. Now, it's about the Pope II, rather than go to the nomads, made an alliance with the Jews. Each ruler and faction was trying to discover which alien group would give them the best advantage over others. So at the end of the 11th century, there were really three factions in Kiev. The old nobility, the pro-Western associates of Svatopolk II, and then the Vesha itself. Old nobility being the boyar class, often military. Svatopolk was a revolutionary. And this newly found local assembly, which existed only for nationalist purposes. It came into existence to support the nation against the sickness of the state. At that point, Svatopolk threw in his lot with the Jews, and they could rule at will. Lev Gumilev says this: the control mechanism was extremely simple. Jewish moneylenders received protection from Kiev and shared their cash with the prince. In turn, he would use this to maintain the army and keep all anti-Jewish forces at bay. Only the death of the prince, though, permitted the people to fight back. The collapse of the old tribal system and the rise of the state separated people from the old pagan traditions. The church was not yet firmly in control. So when you had chaos, you had very few places to go. So factions fought it out for control of the state. Money and finance became very important. Therefore, the Jews were. So the calculations aren't really hard to make. It's a matter of power. The destruction of Jewish usury, though, and the removal by Vladimir Monomakh was significant largely because it restored the power of the church. One of the reasons that Christianization occurred the way it did was because of this legislation. The Russian Empire was to be the opposite of the Khazar mind. And this is, you could read this in document after document after document. Vladimir was the first, we call, gatherer of the Russian lands. The Jews were forwarding money to separatist princes in an effort to permanently divide Russia. Warfare, therefore, had to base the population. Therefore, Jewish usury became a revolutionary development that required a pretty fast intervention of the prince. Because there will be a time where the decay will be so bad that there is no return. This is something that's worthy of note, and people forget this. One example I use quite often is the Taliban movement in Afghanistan. Here you had a country which had never been colonized, two tribes dueling it out, found some unity in Islam, but then was plunged into warfare consistently through the 70s and 80s, and of course, right after today. Well, ultimately, that destroys the morals of the people. They see quick advantage and manipulation as just as right as any virtue. They see power and protection as really the only thing you could offer anybody, patronage, so to speak. Large numbers of people would go to a warlord and he would protect them in exchange for labor. And it really was an economic contract. and nothing more. The Taliban were doing is trying to restore some semblance of normality after that. And it had to be done violently, and had to be done in an extreme way sometimes. Drugs have taken over the economy. Drugs have taken over the mind of Afghans. It's still a big problem today. I don't know if some of you may have seen the American idiots who were training the Afghan army. It's really a comedy show. It's like the Keystone Cops. They say without exception that there's no way we could train these people. And it's because of drugs. They're always high. They do what they want. And the only thing they respect is a man who can sell or buy and protect that trade and make money as a result. Making a national army, so to speak, out of that is impossible. Now, it's bad enough that, you know, it's artificial that the U.S. Is installing these people. The U.S. is encouraging the growth of the opiates, poppies, you know. But that's, you know, it underscores the importance of what the Taliban were doing. They were frightened. They were young. And their basic idea is, if there's ever going to be in Afghanistan again, we absolutely have to resurrect the morals of the people. They have to make babies and take care of those babies. They have to get off drugs. We all know that the UN cited the Taliban once for their eradication of the poppy crop in Afghanistan. They received an award, and their methods were harsh. But the trade to Europe was almost non-existent. Under the Taliban, poppy crops, any of the opiate trades had gone down to zero. There was nothing being grown in the country, and there was no trade. Only upon the U.S. invasion did you have this resurrection in the crop. And that came not only into Europe, but into Russia through Georgia. There's two ports for this, so to speak. The first is the Pamunkey Gorge in Georgia. And the second, of course, as we all know, is Kosovo. Both of these are deep CIA, you know, controlled areas. And it's more proof, as if you need more proof of that, you know, this is what's behind this spike in opiate addiction. Now, I'm not saying that they wouldn't have found something else if, you know, I think that the drug addiction problem is because of alienation. It's because of their lack of any connection with the transcendent. But to be specific, they're able to get their hands on cheap heroin because of the way that the CIA could grease the elites of Kosovo and Pamunkey Gorge in Georgia and get that product to Western Europe and thus to America. Now, the U.S. suffers from this moral decline in the same way that the Afghan population did, although without any war as an excuse. The Ukrainian, Russian people at the time, we're talking about, you know, beginning of the 12th century, were constantly at war, both with foreign powers, European and Asian, and each other. And of course they're connected. Because the first way, you know, you see it in Byzantium too. The first Turkic boots on European soil came from Andronicus. It came from someone who needed them during a civil war and made them a deal. oligarchy will do anything to keep its power. They'll do anything, say anything, be anything. When we use the word whore, this is what we mean. Just this empty shell that you can use at will. That's the nature of republicanism. That's the nature of any system that has this elite backing. What Vladimir Monomakh did was to create a counter-revolution. He created a path of moral regeneration. But he realized that one of the most important aspects of that was economic. And of course, the concern, the money actually doesn't refer to any of the capital, anything you do with the money. The interest just is based on the money itself. Which, of course, doesn't make any sense. There is a certain leeway for an interest charged on capital that's built with the money you might lend. You become a partner with the person. I believe that's the Islamic system these days. That's not the same thing as usury. Usury is only interest charged on the money. In the Islamic the approach to things, if the venture fails, then nothing has to be repaid. In the Jewish view, it always has to be repaid because money doesn't go away. So it has nothing to do with productive capital. And this is essential. This is a huge distinction. There is nothing wrong with charging a premium for the use of money for productive enterprise. But the premium is not really on money, it's on the enterprise. You get your profit only by the success of the capital. And if the capital fails and the business goes out, is gone, then there is no repayment. That's not the same thing as usury. That's not this metaphysical idea that money can make money. That the salty idea of metal being somehow fecund. It is not fertile. Salt is not fertile. This is why I've said this before, but when Lot's wife turned back at Sodom and Gomorrah, she turned into a pillar of salt. Why salt? Of all the things that she could have been. Because salt refers to, number one, homosexuality, and number two, usury. Two extremely infertile and destructive practices. So you have with Vladimir, Saint Vladimir. Remember, there's two Saint Vladimirs then, and he's only been recently canonized. So you have one of his most essential achievements is this anti-usury legislation. And he rebuilt Kiev on his back. This is what resurrected Russia. This is what made Russia possible after this warfare. I don't have hope for Americans. I think most Americans are doomed. But Vladimir wasn't referring to alienated couch potatoes. He was referring to artisans and farmers and those who had been exploited in the past. And Russia is, to a great extent, the creation of Vladimir Monomakh. And this is why he was canonized, and he made the church and his teachings on usury absolutely essential to everything that he was. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson and RadioArian.com.